This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's morning show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's Friday. So that means we wrap up the week by speaking with Karen McKay from the Center for Equitable Library Access. For those of you watching on TV, yes, the camera did froze. And yes, I was looking at my cell phone very, very closely. That's life as a legally blind guy. So hopefully that unfreezes sometime soon if Mr. Freeze leaves us alone while we're talking to Karen McKay. Hey, good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm hoping for no more technical glitches.
Yeah,
no more
Arnold Schwarzenegger yelling, please! But we can only hope. Karen, let's talk about some more literature awards. I always feel like you're really on the cutting edge on this one. So the 2021 Pen Nabokov Award has been handed out, and a Canadian poet was the winner. So who was the poet who won this prize?
So Anne Carson was the poet, and she is probably not as well known in Canadian poetry circles as she could be, but we have a number of books in our collection from her, and she's really worth reading.
Now, I know I've heard the name of this award before, but even as I was thinking about it yesterday, nothing was really jumping around my brain. What does this award in particular recognize?
So the blurb from the website is that it recognizes a living author whose body of work, which is either written in or translated into English, which represents the highest level of achievement in fiction or nonfiction or poetry or drama. So they cover the full spectrum, and they want it to be of enduring originality and consummate craftsmanship. So Anne Carson's poetry is pretty original, and she has a really, you know, pretty robust body of work.
Absolutely. Well, it's very cool to see that work being recognized, and kudos to her for picking up that hardware. Speaking of hardware and awards in the literary world, the 2021 International Booker Prize announced its long list last month. Karen, how many novels are we talking about on this long list? How long is this list?
The long list is 13 novels. So the International Booker Prize celebrates books which have been translated into English from languages and countries from around the world. So 13 is a pretty substantial number.
Absolutely. Does Sila have any of these titles in the collection?
We do. We have about half of them in the collection, and we're waiting for a couple more to potentially come in if we can get them through some exchanges. So we certainly have enough to get you started on reading. And what I love about translated work is that it really centers people in different cultures. There's different flows to different languages. And so the writing has, you know, some different rhythms to it. So reading translated work is really, it's a different experience, I think, than reading works that are written in English.
And what's the timetable for the shortlist as well as what will be the final winner?
So the shortlist comes out on April 22nd, and then they announce the winner in a virtual ceremony on June the 2nd. So pretty quick, and the prize is £50,000, so not
nice.
Not a small amount of money. And that money actually, interestingly, gets split between the author and the translator, because translators often don't get the recognition that they need to. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of an interesting piece.
That's super cool. You're absolutely right, because the translation is a huge part of that art form. I remember I read The Master and Margarita in the mid-2000s, and I kept saying to my friend, Dimitri, I don't really like this. This is no good. He says, you should read it in Russian. It's beautiful. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to learn Russian just to read this book, but the point is well taken. Hey, let's talk about a couple of an author here. Author Lee Beverly Cleary, the world of children's books, bid a sad farewell to a legendary writer in Beverly Cleary. How many books had Beverly Cleary written?
So she wrote more than 40. Almost all of them were aimed at children, and she wrote some of the most memorable characters in children's literature. Almost everybody knows Ramona Quimbley, Ralph S. Mouse, and Henry Higgins. I read those books to my kids when they were little. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about what she did before she was a writer.
So she actually was a librarian, so near and dear to my own heart and to the hearts of the staff at CELA. And it said that she started to write children's books because her young patrons said to her that they could not find books that represented the lives that they were living and the realities they were living in. And so that's what started her on her writing journey. She said that it was one of the greatest gifts of her life, those comments and the opportunity to write those books for children. So she died at the ripe old age of 104. We were lucky to have her.
Oh, wow. Yeah, 104. That's, you know, again, I was saying to Nazreen in the last segment that obviously losing anyone is always going to be a bit of a sad day, but 104 is a heck of a good run, and glad that she was able to spend so much time bringing so much joy to people's lives. Are there any books of hers in the Sela collection?
Yeah, so we have almost all of her books in our collection in one format or another. Later in her life, she sort of aggregated different stories. Like there's Ramona and her father's stories and Ramona and her mother's stories as well. So we have those sort of aggregated collections.
Oh, very good.
So lots and lots to read. Yeah.
Very, very good. And Karen, as always, we like to wrap up our segment and wrap up the week with a bit of highlighted material from Sela's collection that has a theme. And today's theme is Zoo Lovers Day, which was yesterday. So you've got a couple to talk about here. One is Our Zoo by Penelope Denning from 2015. Also, June Motorshead was part of this one as well. So tell us about Our Zoo.
So this is a really interesting story. It's a memoir written by June with help from Penelope Denning. And June's father, George, wanted to build his own zoo. It was his lifelong dream right from when he was a child. So he buys some land and they start to build the zoo. And the book is all about June's experiences growing up with the animals. She's isolated. There's not a lot of kids around. Her sister's older. And so her friends become the animals. So Chester Zoo, which is the name of the zoo, is actually one of the top 10 zoos in the world. There's over 11,000 animals and 400 species, and it's the most visited zoo in Britain. And so he started literally from nothing and built up this incredible zoo. So the book talks not only about June's memories of her time with the animals, it also talks about the staff. And you get to sort of see an interesting perspective of a child watching a father fulfill a childhood dream. So lots and lots of sort of interesting tidbits there. She goes on to actually, help with the zoo, run the zoo, and she helps restore it after the war. So she actually becomes the zookeeper who helps keep it running during the World War. And so really lots of lovely stories about it. We get to know the animals and her family quite well. It's been made into a TV show, which aired on the BBC. So there are 6 episodes to rave reviews. So it's really a lovely story.
Excellent.
Yeah, lovely story.
We've also got one here called The Great Zoo of China, a thriller by Matthew Riley.
Yeah, I don't know if you know Matthew Riley's work, but he is an incredible writer. So this story takes place in China, obviously, and the Chinese government's been keeping a secret for 40 years, and now it's ready to tell its story. So he invites some VIPs from the United States and a contingent of journalists to come and see this, what they're calling the Great Zoo of China. And among those people coming is CJ Cameron, who's an expert on reptiles and specifically crocodiles. So I'm giving you a little hint here as to what you're going to find in the zoo. And so they arrive at the zoo. It's of a scale that they never would have thought before. And the Chinese government thinks they have everything under control, but the reality is things get a little bit crazy. So Matthew Riley writes fairly gory kinds of books. So you got to be prepared for that.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the criticisms of his work is that he doesn't really develop characters super well because he likes to kill them off.
Right.
Say that. But yeah, so CJ Cameron actually is pretty well developed for one of his characters. The book is really fast paced. It's bloody and it's messy for sure. And you need to suspend belief a little bit. But if you do, you're in for a real treat. It's one of those sort of can't miss combos of a fast paced, exciting story. It's very entertaining. But yeah, it's a bit of a candy bar, but it's a good read.
Okay. A little bit of a Jurassic Park vibe there. Jurassic Park with crocodiles. And crocodiles are kind of dinosaurs, so it all works out. We're staying in the theme of looking abroad. We have one here called Babylon's Ark, The Incredible Wartime Rescue of the Baghdad Zoo by Lawrence Anthony and Graham Spence.
So this is really an incredible true story. Lawrence Anthony was a South African conservationist, and once the Iraq War began, he could only think about the fate of the Baghdad Zoo, which is located right in the city center, and so it was caught in the crossfire of the war. So through some kind of complex maneuvers, he makes his way to Iraq, and he starts, after the American invasion, and he starts to try and save the animals and save what's left of the Baghdad Zoo. He's an incredible leader. He brings together the former deputy director of the zoo, a number of brave volunteers and staff, some American soldiers, and they all try to figure out ways to help these animals who've been left to starve. They're in dirty cages. Many of them have been killed. Mm. So it sounds like a horrible story, but actually it's quite uplifting. There's some broader takeaways. He has a he lays out a pretty compelling sort of problem-solving guide. So if you're into sort of leadership and that sort of thing, there's a bit of a take on it in this book for you. But he also really does a great job of centering the story in the context of the war and the realities that that brings not only onto the animals, but the people who've lived through it. So if you read it, you kind of come away with a deeper and maybe a more nuanced understanding of that conflict through an interesting take, you know, through the zoo. So
yeah,
very interesting story.
It's definitely a reminder of a lot of the history of Iraq and Baghdad that that predates a lot of the tensions that we saw with the first Gulf War and the second invasion in 2003, and even things like literature and libraries and literacy rates, yeah, that Iraq was one of the leaders in the world before the troubles that came along with some international political wrangling. Karen, let's jump into the last one here. Speaking of international political wrangling, this one was The Zookeeper's War, an incredible true story from the Cold War by J.M. Monhaupt.
So this is one of those books that kind of makes you feel like truth might be stranger than fiction. It's a story that I'd never heard, so it intrigued me. So it takes place, obviously, in Berlin, and both East Berlin and West Berlin had a zoo, and they quickly became symbols of the divided city's two different halves, the two different political philosophies. And so what happens is the head zookeepers on each side of the wall started an animal's arms race, which seems kind of weird. So they stockpile the most pandas and hippos, and they, you know, they eventually get state funds diverted towards giving these new animals great big lavish enclosures. And West politicians or West German politicians start talking about zoo policy on their campaign trail. So it's a very interesting view on how the two political systems sort of, you know, develop into this odd arms race with animals. But it's more than that. So one of the characters we meet is Katharina Henross, and she is the first female zoo director at the Berlin Zoo. She held that position from 1945 until 1956. So she took over when the war had sort of ravaged the zoo. There were only, I think, about 90 animals left of the 4,000 that had remained. And she really had to fight sort of the old boys club to restore the zoo and to properly care for the animals. She was under immense pressure from the board to give way and let a man take over. So I always love those, you know, women come out on top kind of stories. But yeah, so it's a very interesting way to view politics through an animal story, but also human nature and, you know, good triumphing over evil. There's lots of sort of big picture bits in here, but it all comes from this very kind of quirky true story.
Karen, I have to say, I'm not surprised, but I love the approach you're taking here with Zoo Day. What a way to tie in some literature to that. Really well done. Thank you so much for highlighting these articles for us, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.